A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us this time. He's been doing consulting work in Israel for years, in and out of different organizations, and he's noticed something that anyone who's watched Silicon Valley knows. Funding is no guarantee of basic functionality. You see a startup that just raised a multi-million dollar seed round, and you assume they know what they're doing. They've got a clear direction, but in capital-rich markets, that's often not the case. So he's asking us to dig up the most extreme, entertaining examples of companies that raised enormous amounts of money without actually deciding what they plan to do or how they plan to make money. The ones with the hype and easy VC cash created genuinely confusing circumstances for the people hired into those organizations. Basically, startups that got rich before they got coherent.
The most dangerous phrase in a startup isn't, "We're failing." It's, "We just raised $100 million.
That's the hook right there.
It sounds like good news. It makes headlines. Your parents finally understand what you do. But what it actually means, in a lot of cases, is that the discipline of figuring out what your company is for just got postponed indefinitely. You now have years of runway to avoid asking the one question you should have answered before you took a single dollar.
Daniel's seen this up close. He's walked into well-funded Israeli startups where the bank account is overflowing, and nobody can explain what the product actually does, or who's supposed to buy it. Meanwhile, he's worked with bootstrap shops that are lean, focused, and weirdly functional, precisely because they can't afford not to be.
The signal-to-noise ratio of funding rounds collapsed during the peak. 2021-2022, you had seed rounds that looked like Series B rounds from 5 years earlier, and everyone assumed that meant something. Big check equals big validation. But a lot of those checks were written on FOMO, not diligence. The investor didn't validate the business model. They validated the founder's ability to tell a story.
The funding became a liability disguised as an asset. It looked like proof of direction when it was actually permission to delay finding one. And the people who suffered most weren't the founders who walked away with golden parachutes. It was the employees who signed up for a mission that didn't exist.
Which is exactly what Daniel's getting at. He's not asking about fraud, necessarily. He's asking about confusion. The organizational chaos that happens when a company has more money than clarity.
Lucky for Daniel, the last decade has produced some truly spectacular examples. I mean, we're talking companies that raised hundreds of millions of dollars and couldn't answer the most basic question, what do we actually do?
Let's unpack why that happens. Why a big bank account can be the worst thing to happen to a young company. The core paradox is this. VC funding is supposed to be a vote of confidence. Sophisticated investors, deep due diligence, smart money backing the winners. That's the story. But what Daniel's observed, and what the data actually shows, is that a massive funding round often masks a complete absence of product market fit, sometimes a complete absence of even knowing what the product is.
It's the opposite of what we're trained to think. You see a headline, startup raises $80 million in Series B, and your brain goes, well, someone smart kicked the tires, someone checked the math.
In a lot of cases, nobody checked the math. They checked the narrative, the founder's charisma, the quality of the pitch deck, the fear of missing the next big thing.
I've seen this play out in Israeli tech. Daniel's consulting experience mirrors what I've observed. You walk into a company that just closed a $30 million round, and the energy is electric, everyone's celebrating. But you ask five employees what the company actually does, and you get six different answers. Meanwhile, the bootstrap shop down the street has three people, zero press, and their roadmap is carved in stone because if they get it wrong, they don't eat.
Funding as a curse. It sounds counterintuitive, but it's real. When capital is abundant, the discipline of figuring out what you actually do gets postponed indefinitely. You don't need customers because you have investors. You don't need revenue because you have runway. You don't need clarity because you have enough money to keep pivoting forever.
That's the thesis, isn't it? The money doesn't solve the confusion. It funds it. It pays for years of organizational drift. Talented people get hired into a vacuum, told to build something exciting, but nobody can articulate what success looks like, because nobody defined what the company is for.
The result is wasted talent, burned out employees, and sometimes spectacular public failure. The kind where everyone looks back and wonders how nobody saw it coming.
The answer is, plenty of people saw it coming. They just weren't the ones writing the checks.
To understand how this plays out at its most extreme, we have to start with Juicero. And I need to be clear, this is not a parody. This actually happened. A company raised $120 million to build a $700 countertop juicer that squeezed proprietary packets of pre-chopped fruit.
A $700 machine to squeeze a bag.
Not just any machine. This thing applied 4 tons of force, Wi-Fi connected. It scanned a QR code on each packet to check freshness and disable the machine if the packet was expired. The engineering was impressive, if you ignore the fact that the entire value proposition collapsed under the weight of a single question.
What happens when someone just squeezes the bag?
Bloomberg's reporters tested it. They squeezed a Juicero packet by hand and got nearly the same amount of juice in less time than the machine took. The machine took about a minute and a half. Hands took about 90 seconds. The video went viral. The company was dead within months.
Here's what I want to understand. How did $120 million get poured into a machine that was out-squeezed by human fingers? What was the mechanism?
The mechanism was narrative. Doug Evans, the founder, was a master storyteller. He'd already sold a juice company before. He framed Juicero as a health tech hardware convenience revolution. The pitch was that busy people wanted fresh juice but hated cleaning juicers. The packet solved the mess. The machine was the platform. Investors bought the story without ever asking the most basic question. Does this actually solve a problem that needs solving?
The money made it worse. Once you've raised that much, you can't just sell a simple product. You have to build something that justifies the valuation. So they over-engineered it. 4 tons of force. A supply chain for proprietary packets. A luxury brand. They hired people to build all of this. Supply chain experts, hardware engineers, brand marketers, none of whom were asking whether the core idea made sense, because the funding itself was treated as proof that it did.
That's the organizational confusion Daniel's talking about. Employees joined Juicero thinking they were building the future of nutrition. They were actually building a Rube Goldberg machine for something your hands could do. And nobody inside could say it because the money kept flowing and the narrative kept spinning.
I want to pause on that point, because it's the heart of the whole thing. The money didn't just fail to fix the problem. It actively prevented anyone from identifying the problem. You've got $120 million in the bank. You've got investors like Kleiner Perkins and Google Ventures on your cap table. The social proof is overwhelming. So if you're an engineer at Juicero and you think, wait, why are we building a 4-ton press for a bag of fruit? The weight of all that capital and all those prestigious names is pushing back against your doubt. You assume you must be missing something. The investors must know something you don't.
The funding becomes an argument from authority. It short-circuits the critical thinking that would have killed the bad idea on day one. And by the time the Bloomberg video drops, you've spent 3 years of your career and a significant chunk of your professional reputation on a product that gets defeated by a pair of hands.
Then there's Theranos, which takes the same mechanism, narrative over substance, and dials it to 11.
Theranos raised over $700 million. Peak valuation of $9 billion. The board included George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, James Mattis. Investors included Rupert Murdoch and the Walton family. These are not naive people. These are the most sophisticated money on the planet, and they all bought into a blood testing technology that never worked.
Elizabeth Holmes had the narrative down cold. The black turtleneck. The deep voice. The story of a young woman terrified of needles who was going to revolutionize lab testing with a single finger prick. It was compelling. It was also completely fabricated.
Here's where the funding mechanism directly enabled the fraud. A normal lab testing company has to process samples and deliver results to paying customers. If the machines don't work, customers complain. Theranos didn't need customers. They had investors. So when the Edison machines failed, they just ran the tests on commercial analyzers from Siemens and diluted the samples. They hid behind NDAs. They siloed departments so engineers in one wing had no idea what chemists in the other wing were doing.
The money was a shield against reality.
It was a fortress. Employees who raised concerns were threatened with legal action. Whistleblowers were intimidated. The funding created this aura of legitimacy that made it terrifying to ask the obvious question, does this thing actually work? And by the time John Carreyrou's reporting cracked it open in the Wall Street Journal, the company had burned through hundreds of millions of dollars and put actual patients at risk with inaccurate test results.
What strikes me about both cases is that the money wasn't just wasted, it was actively destructive. It paid for the architecture of the deception, the NDAs, the secretive culture, the over-engineered hardware, the charismatic branding. All of it was funded by investors who confused a good story with a good business.
In both cases, the employees were the ones left holding the bag, literally in Juicero's case.
That's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. We focus on the founder, the Holmes trial, the Newman exit package. But the real story is the thousands of people who took these jobs believing they were joining something real. They moved cities. They turned down other offers. They bought the equity pitch.
The hired into confusion. Problem. It's the knock-on effect that outlasts the headlines. When a startup has no clear direction, employees are the ones who absorb the chaos. They join for the mission, the equity, the promise, and they land in organizations with no roadmap, conflicting priorities, and a culture of performative work. Busyness without business.
That's the phrase. Meetings about meetings, decks about decks, everyone signaling productivity because nobody can define what productive actually means.
WeWork is the apotheosis of this. $12 billion raised, peak valuation of $47 billion. And at its core, it was a real estate company that had convinced itself, and SoftBank, that it was a tech platform. The S-1 filing was a masterpiece of obfuscation. $1.6 billion in losses on $1.8 billion in revenue. Their signature metric was community-adjusted EBITDA, which was just a creative way of hiding how much money they were hemorrhaging.
Community-adjusted EBITDA. That's not a financial metric. That's a cry for help.
The organizational confusion was systemic. Sales teams were incentivized to sign long leases at any cost, because growth was the only thing that mattered for the next round. Product teams were building features nobody asked for, like WeWork's proprietary social network, because the company had to look like a tech company. And then you had thousands of community managers whose job was essentially to make the free beer feel meaningful.
I remember reading accounts from former employees. They described being hired into these roles with no clear KPIs, no performance framework, just this vague mandate to elevate the world's consciousness. That's a direct quote from the S-1. The company's stated mission was to elevate the world's consciousness. They were subleasing office space.
SoftBank's Vision Fund created a perverse incentive structure. The game wasn't build a sustainable business, it was optimized for the next round. Get big enough, fast enough, and someone with a $100 billion fund will have to keep writing checks. Masayoshi Son personally encouraged Newman to think bigger, crazier, to treat the company like a movement rather than a business. And Newman was happy to oblige.
You have this feedback loop. Founder tells a story. Investor buys the story and demands the story get bigger. The bigger story requires more money. The more money requires an even bigger story. And somewhere in that loop, the actual business, the thing where revenue exceeds costs, just evaporates.
The common thread across all three, Juicero, Theranos, WeWork, is that the absence of a real business model was hidden by a compelling narrative. Health tech hardware revolution. Democratizing lab testing. Elevating the world's consciousness. Investors bought the story, not the math. Employees were hired to execute a vision that didn't exist.
Daniel's seen a version of this in Israel. The startup nation ethos is real. Israel produces incredible companies. But it also produces a specific kind of dysfunction. The pressure to raise big rounds is a status signal. The founder, whose primary skill is fundraising, not building. I've walked into organizations where the CEO could close a $20 million round in his sleep, but couldn't tell you what the product roadmap looked like 6 months out.
The fundraising CEO is a recognizable type. Charming, visionary, incredible on stage. But if you look at their calendar, they spend zero time on product, zero time on customers. Their job is the next round, and that works until the music stops.
I want to dig into that type for a second, because I think it's more common than people realize. The fundraising CEO is often talented at fundraising. They've mastered the performance. They know exactly when to drop the hockey stick graph, when to mention the prestigious advisor, when to hint at the term sheet from the competing firm. It's a skill set. The problem is it has nothing to do with building a company. And if you're an employee being recruited by this person, the very thing that impresses you in the interview, the big round, the big vision, the big names, is the thing that should worry you most.
Because you're not being hired to build a business. You're being hired to be set dressing for the next fundraise. Your role exists to make the company look like it's doing something, so that when the CEO walks into the next pitch meeting, they can point to a growing headcount and a busy org chart as evidence of momentum.
Which is why I keep coming back to the bootstrap companies. These were businesses that figured out what they were before they took a dollar of outside money. They had to. MailChimp was a side project for years. Basecamp built project management software for themselves, and only later realized other people might pay for it. The direction was clear from day one because confusion wasn't funded.
The contrast is instructive. When you can't afford to be confused, you figure things out fast. When every hire has to pay for itself, you don't create roles with no KPIs. When your next month's payroll depends on actual customers paying actual money, you don't have the luxury of community-adjusted EBITDA.
What do we do with this? Daniel's watching these organizations from the inside. How do you avoid being the person who joins a company that doesn't know what it is?
First, for founders, and I know a lot of them listen, treat funding as a tool, not a validation. If you can't explain your business model in one sentence to a stranger at a bus stop, no amount of VC money will fix that. The money doesn't answer the question. It just makes the silence more expensive.
Not a paragraph. Not a deck. If you need a preamble to explain what you do, you haven't figured out what you do.
Second, for employees. When you're interviewing at a funded startup, ask this exact question: what happens if we don't raise another round?
That's the litmus test.
If the answer is panic, deflection, or some version of that won't happen, run. A real business survives on revenue, not the next check. If the company's entire plan is raise more money, you're not joining a startup. You're joining a fundraising operation that happens to employ people.
I'd add, watch the interviewer's face when you ask it. You'll learn more from the micro-expression than the answer.
Third, for investors, demand to see the unit economics before the vision deck. Juicero, Theranos, WeWork, all three had beautiful pitch decks and terrible math. Gorgeous slides about changing the world and no answer to what does it cost to acquire a customer and what do they pay you?
The vision deck is a seduction. The unit economics are a background check. And nobody wants to admit they got seduced without running the check.
The pattern across every case we've discussed is the same. Narrative outran math, and nobody stopped to ask the boring questions until it was too late.
Here's the open question. We're in a post-CIRP world now. The era of free money is over. VC funding has tightened dramatically. Are we actually seeing fewer of these funding without direction? Startups? Or is the pattern just evolving into something harder to spot?
I think it's evolving. The Juiceros and WeWorks were products of a specific moment, when capital was so abundant that due diligence became optional. That specific flavor of excess is harder to find now. But the underlying dynamic hasn't gone anywhere. Founders still tell stories. Investors still get swept up. The difference is, the stakes are higher because the next round isn't guaranteed.
The confusion gets compressed. Instead of drifting for years on a giant pile of cash, companies now have maybe 18 months to figure out they don't know what they're doing. The chaos is faster and quieter.
Faster and quieter is a good way to put it. You don't get the spectacular public implosions as often. You get startups that quietly run out of money before anyone outside ever hears about them. The employees still get burned. They just don't get a Netflix documentary out of it.
I wonder if that's actually worse in some ways. At least with a WeWork-scale implosion, the employees get a kind of collective validation. The world acknowledges what happened. Your resume has a recognizable scar on it, and people understand the context. But if you spend 2 years at a startup that quietly evaporates, you're left explaining a gap in your employment history with a company name nobody recognizes, and the story sounds like a personal failure, even though it wasn't your fault at all.
That's a real psychological cost. The public failures become cautionary tales. The quiet failures just become private disappointments. And the employee who got hired into confusion carries that confusion forward into their next job search, trying to make sense of an experience that never made sense to begin with.
Which brings me to the final thought I keep circling back to. The best companies are often the ones you never hear about. Profitable, boring, focused. They don't make headlines because there's nothing dramatic about a business that knows what it is and executes quietly. The next time you see a startup raise a massive round, the question isn't, what will they build? It's, what are they hiding?
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, the Guild of Goldsmiths in Nuremberg required apprentices to produce a masterwork cup before they could be admitted as journeymen, and records show that roughly 1 in 7 applicants failed this final examination at least twice before passing. The guild maintained detailed records of these failures, including one apprentice who attempted the Masterwork Cup 4 times over a period of 11 years before finally succeeding in 1523. The cup he eventually produced is still held in the German National Museum.
Right. So the goldsmith equivalent of a startup that finally found product market fit after 11 years of iterating.
The runway on that apprentice was remarkable. Someone was writing checks.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.